There is an interesting split within the environmental NGO community, the non-governmental organizations. It's termed bright greens and dark greens. The bright greens look at the market as the solution, businesses' allies, so Environmental Defense Fund, NRDC, WRI. The dark greens look at the market as the problem and business as the enemy, Greenpeace, Earth First, Earth Liberation Front, PETA. They each have a role to play. One is about purity, the dark greens. One is about pragmatism, the bright greens. One is about consensus. One is about conflict. And they each make the conversation possible. They're both part of the mosaic of driving change.
The clip we just heard from Andy Hoffman, who's a professor at the University of Michigan Business School, speaks to a rift between bright greens and dark greens. This rift actually goes back over 100 years. Seriously, we looked it up on Wikipedia. And according to Wikipedia, the bulk of conservation history has roots in America that trace back to the late 19th century. At that time, there's this interesting distinction between conservationists, led by Teddy Roosevelt, and environmentalists, led by John Muir and his Sierra Club. Those fights came to a head with the Hetch Hetchy Dam in Yosemite National Park. Environmental issues popped up again during the Great Depression. The National Forest Service expanded, and the New Deal launched programs for dam construction throughout the West. A generation later, we had Rachel Carson, hippies, Earth Day, and landmark legislation. Are we at another generational crossroads today? Facing climate change, ocean acidification, mass extinction, industrialized agriculture, and urbanization of the planet? Welcome to Generation Anthropocene. I'm your host, Mike Osborne. Conservation and environmentalism are at their best when they're informed by state-of-the-art science. So where is the science today? The quote from Andy Hoffman at the beginning was part of a series of interviews our team recorded at the Aldo Leopold Conference for Earth Science Communication. This conference was part of a training program for scientists who want to reach a broader audience. Four of us from the Generation Anthropocene team made the trip to the conference, and on today's show, we're going to share some of our favorite moments. Our goal today is to take stock of where the science is. In the face of planetary change, we want to ask the question, what is the aim of conservation in the 21st century? Our first piece is from Karen Lips, who's been working in Central America since the 1980s. And as Karen told co-producer Miles Traer, she's seen frog extinctions sweep across her field site. As it turns out, these extinctions are occurring worldwide.
Well, just by dumb luck, I was in a place up in the mountains of Central America where this thing was happening. And so after 3 years working on my dissertation, I came back 1 year and there were no frogs. People all around the world were saying, I can't find my frogs, my salamanders are super rare. And so at this point then, because we actually had dead frogs, that was sort of the smoking gun. Because we actually now had something that we could look at and examine and figure out, why are they dead? Everywhere else, people would go back and it was too late, right? It was like, one day they're there, the next day you go back, they're gone. But there's, what do you study? What do you compare, right?
One of the sort of revealing things that's come across for myself and conducting these interviews and listening to them is that so little attention seems to be paid. You know, obviously that's in the public eye is global climate change, but so little attention seems to be paid to mass extinctions.
Shockingly, right?
Yeah.
I still don't think that most people truly appreciate how bad it really is, because only somebody like me where I can watch it. You know, I'm like one of the few people who have actually seen a place go from hundreds and hundreds of frogs in a couple hours to nothing. And it really is to nothing. This gets at what I think the biggest issue is this shifting baseline. Part of it, too, is this idea that, I mean, not everyone can go to Panama and see how bad it is, and most people never saw what it used to be like. So that is that shifting baseline.
So there's no reference for
There's him. No reference. Or what your reference is low already. And it's that shifting baseline, I think, that makes it very difficult.
Karen Lips was the first person to key us into this idea of shifting baselines, which has actually been around for quite a while. Nature is always changing, so people have different experiences for the baseline of the natural world. But this raises the question, if we're interested in conservation, then what exactly are we conserving? Are we trying to preserve nature in some perfect state that may no longer exist? And how exactly do we do that if our understanding of what's normal is transitory? This issue came up again in an interview with Dove Sachs. Generation Anthropocene contributor Leslie Chang was talking with Dove about shifting baselines and invasive species.
The current view that we have in the U.S. that non-native species are a big problem is relatively new. That's not the way people viewed it 100 years ago, and it may not be the way people view it 100 years from now. Species were introduced all over the world for the utilitarian values that they could provide to people.
How much is this an issue that people need to be thinking about or like worrying about on a daily basis?
I actually think people worry about it too much. I think that non-native species can be a large conservation problem, but I think it's been blown out of proportion in a lot of cases. And I think a lot of people have lost their objectivity about it as a consequence. And there is this big debate in the literature right now in the field of invasion biology about to what extent have we been vilifying non-native species in an unscientific way. I actually think that it has to do with human nature and that humans don't like change. And so we'll often talk about non-native species causing harm to an environment where what they've done is change the relative abundance of different species. So maybe there was a tree, and there used to be 100 trees of this species in this one forest, and now there's only 50 trees of that species. So is that harm? It's certainly change. And you know, don't get me wrong, there are cases, particularly on islands, where non-native species have come in and caused extinctions. And there are certainly cases where non-native species cause economic harm. And, of course, there's lots of cases where they cause economic benefit. So it's a mixed bag. But I think this aspect of people having sort of angst about change has a lot to do with it. I mean, think about it. Part of it depends on, like, what you're interested in. You know, in California, there haven't been extinctions of organisms, of natives, because of exotics. So if you're concerned about extinctions, then exotics haven't been a problem. But they've certainly transformed landscapes. You know, so, you know, grasslands in California are dominated by exotic grasses, grasses from other parts of the world. And so, you know, the grasslands that used to exist there are gone. And so, you know, that is something that someone might get sad about. It has to do with your frame of reference, I guess.
The frame of reference Dove is talking about is the same thing Karen Lips was talking about with shifting baselines. In Karen's case, species extinction causes the baseline to shift. But in Dove's example, there are no extinctions. There's just a transformation of a landscape. Maybe the reason we've vilified invasive species is that we're nostalgic for landscapes that no longer exist. In this whole discussion of changing baselines, the elephant in the room, of course, is climate change. Ask any climate scientist, and they'll tell you that the problem is not that the planet is warming up, but that the planet is warming up fast. It's the rate of change that matters. In the history of conservation, we've never had to deal with anything as daunting as global warming. And yet, Americans seem to be indifferent to the risks of climate change. For those of us living in the developed world, the cynical but honest question to ask is, why does climate change matter? Leslie put this question directly to global ecologist Chris Field.
You know, I think that we are fooling ourselves in the U.S. if we say the impacts of climate change are really somebody else's problem. The impacts of climate change are global problems, not only because we're vulnerable in many cases, but because events in the modern world have a way of becoming global, even if they're concentrated in someplace far away from you.
Yesterday, after the conference and stuff, that we met with the Generation Anthropocene team, and we were talking about what is kind of the best way to frame environmental issues. And we were talking about framing it in a way that is environment for people rather than environment for the environment's sake. And I was just wondering what you think about that.
My personal feeling is that it certainly is true that we get a wide range of important ecosystems, goods and services from environment, but there are also a tremendous number of environmental values that may not be connected with things that help human societies. And personally, I really hope that as we move forward, we don't shift to such a narrow ecosystem goods and services perspective that we miss other really important stewardship components. And at least for me, I see biological diversity as one of, it's a great richness, a great source of wealth that, you know, we're kind of empowered to protect. So I'm concerned about too narrow a focus on only ecosystem goods and services as the holding vessel for environmental values.
Does biodiversity itself have inherent value? Some environmentalists say yes, that we should preserve the environment for the environment's sake, not just for the benefit of societies. But the truth is that protecting biodiversity, even apart from ecosystem services, is still about people. Ecosystem services may be important for overall quality of life, but they aren't the whole story. The natural world can have symbolic meaning. Earth history and cultural heritage are intimately linked. I spoke with Luis Zambrano about the significance of a rare salamander in the wetlands surrounding Mexico City. This salamander is called an axolotl. And by the way, it's totally worth doing a Google image search for axolotl, spelled A-X-O-L-O-T-L. They're hilarious looking. They have these big heads with funny branching spines sticking out. Honestly, they look like a Pokemon character. Anyway, here's what Luis had to say about axolotls.
I receive this question all the time that, well, this axolotl, what is it for? I mean, is it food? No. Well, it used to be food in the Aztec cultures. Not anymore, because it's not like it tastes bad. It's like because the shape is not tasteful.
Right.
But
tastes like chicken, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. But you see the salamander and say, oh, I don't want to eat this.
Right.
In the Occidental way of thinking. So they also are not particularly a top predator that controls all the community. So if you get rid of those animals, then
it's not a keystone species.
It's not a keystone species. But culturally, yes. I mean, the axolotl, the name of axolotl comes from xolotl. And xolotl was the name of the twin brother of the most important Aztec god, which was Quetzalcoatl. So it's like god,
yeah,
having a twin, and the twin is xolotl. This god had the facility to transform in any animal or plant that he wanted. And at the end, he finished in an axolotl shape. So for Aztecs, it was very important, this animal, because it was the twin of the most important god, the twin brother of the most important god. So
And so there's a cultural significance.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is part of our life quality. I mean, it's... I always say that we are Mexicans and we are different from the different countries because we have a particular part of our culture, and the culture is attached to the biodiversity. If we lose our biodiversity, we are losing part of our Mexican
heritage.
Exactly. Yeah. So that is one of the important part of the life quality from my point of view. I mean, I prefer to have an axolotl knowing that it's still surviving there than having apartments.
Yeah, or malls or whatever.
Exactly.
For the Generation Anthropocene team, Luis Zambrano stood out from the other Leopold fellows. Most of the people we talked to at the conference live and work in the U.S. Luis lives and works in Mexico City, where issues of hunger, poverty, and economic stability are often much more pressing than environmental concerns. And yet, as Louise points out, this funny-looking salamander is symbolic of a higher quality of life. At Generation Anthropocene, a question we like to ask all of our interviewees is, where would you place the boundary for the Anthropocene? When I put this question to Luis Zambrano, he surprised me with his answer.
It's different in different areas. I mean, it's different. I've seen that we are following the path that U.S. stand about 50 years or 60 years ago. I mean, the fights we are doing at this moment in Mexico City were fought in New York City, for example, in the 30s or 40s.
Right.
So, and if you see the story, I mean, the history, you see that two or three different things happened 100 years ago in Europe. Mm-hmm. So from my point of view, it's not one moment that
right.
the whole humankind is something like, okay, the development of each country created different moments.
At first, when Luis said that the boundary for the Anthropocene is different in different places, I was confused by his answer. After all, the Anthropocene is supposed to be a geologic boundary for the entire planet. But then it struck me that I was missing the bigger point. The Anthropocene is not about a sudden and abrupt planetary transformation. It's the realization that human and natural systems are inseparable. And it's a realization that only emerges when a society's material needs are satisfied. The Anthropocene is as much a cultural shift as it is a geologic boundary. Susie Mosier seemed to grasp the importance of this message. Here's what she had to say about the Anthropocene as a cultural shift.
You know, it's a really different place that we're perceiving ourselves to be in. If we're thinking, you know, we're this small and inconsequential in some ways, versus we are a earth-changing force, at least collectively. And I find that that is a dramatic demand, that implies a dramatic demand on our psyches and on our self-understanding as a species and as a society. And I find that just really, it's a big one, you know, to really explore. And then the questions that follows from that is, so if we accept even that we are such a force, you know, should we be like gods? Should we control the whole thing? I mean, we used to leave that up to gods, right? When anything was bigger than what we controlled, well, that was God's will. I mean, that's our cultural language for these things, right? So now that we are like gods, we're actually causing very huge changes. Should we be perfect at it? In other words, we can control everything. I can control everything outside tomorrow, you know, who gets food, who doesn't get food, what the weather is, where it will rain, where it will, you know, be sunshine. I mean, literally, should we be really powerful in this, or should we try to actually reduce our footprint and our influence, and in that way become, you know, a much more subdued, but still a conscious of our imprint force on the planet. So I find those, you know, deeper philosophical questions that become very quickly policy questions. I mean, you know, when I raise the issue of should we be able to control the weather, I mean, this is already being talked about under geoengineering and things like that. Should I control what species get to live and not to live? That's bioengineering, right? It's genetic engineering. So all of these questions are maybe the philosophical framing of it, but they're already out there in what people do on a daily basis in their jobs. So where is that conversation? I want to have that conversation with a larger public.
In 1804, global population crossed 1 billion. 20 years after Roosevelt and Muir battled over Hetch Hetchy, we crossed 2 billion in 1927. We passed the Clean Air Act and Endangered Species Act, and then topped 4 billion in 1975. And in 2011, we hit the 7 billion mark. But something interesting happened about 50 years ago. The rate of population increase slowed down. So in other words, We're still adding more and more people, but we're adding people at a much slower rate. Eventually, the birth rate is going to equal the death rate. The best estimate is that sometime around 2050, global population will stabilize around 9 billion. When we hit that peak, Generation Anthropocene is going to be there to witness the moment. The good news is that we now know what we're dealing with. If we want everyone to have a bed in 2050, we're going to need 9 billion mattresses. If we want everyone to have access to safe drinking water, we're going to need 9 billion faucets. And if we want everyone to be connected, we're going to need 9 billion cell phones. The question before us now is, what do we want for the people living on the planet today, and what will we preserve for the 9 billion who will be here in a generation? Is modern environmentalism confined to discussions of ecosystem services, or are we neglecting the social and cultural values embedded in biodiversity and natural landscapes? Can our conservation goals be integrated with rapidly shifting baselines? And when we arrive at the inevitable conclusion that our collective actions represent a geologic force, how far are we willing to go in assuming responsibility over that power? Looking back on the Leopold Conference, it's surprising how quickly our conversations turned from scientific to philosophical. But then again, science is meant to scrutinize our most deeply held assumptions. Maybe the most important thing Generation Anthropocene learned at the Leopold Conference is that the scientific process still works this way. Everyone we spoke to began by questioning assumptions of how the world works. In the history of science, big changes come when we start asking big questions. So as we embark upon the next 40 years, what's the big question we need to be asking ourselves? I guess that question is for you. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. Today's contributors were Samantha Larson, Leslie Chang, and co-producer Miles Traer. Thanks as always to co-producer and guru Tom Hayden. Thanks also to Margaret Krebs, Pam Sterner, and all of the fellows at the Aldo Leopold Leadership Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford 90.1. You can follow us on Twitter at GenAnthropocene, or you can email us at genanthropocene@gmail.com. I'm Mike Osborne, reminding you to ask the big questions.